Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the first of our series on our 32nd president. And thank you for both skipping a tennis game and beginning your celebrations a little late. It's much obliged. My name is Jay Barksdale. I am a librarian upstairs in this great library, and in addition, it's my pleasure to administer the two research study rooms, the Wertheim Study and the Allen Room. Both are for scholars and writers who have demonstrated a need of long-term use of our materials. And today's speaker is certainly most qualified. Susan Butler is a graduate of Bennington and Columbia. She is a McDowell Fellow, historian, and biographer. She stumbled upon forgotten World War II letters of Roosevelt and Stalin at the Franklin Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park. She immediately recognized their importance and compiled her second book, Dear Mr. Stalin, which offers a revealing look into the minds of two great men through the progression of the war, beginning with a letter Roosevelt wrote to Stalin offering aid to the Soviet Union, and ending with a message approved by Roosevelt only minutes before he was struck down by a cerebral hemorrhage. It has been extensively reviewed in London, where it provoked a firestorm of criticism because the messages between them, by their nature and subject, reveal Churchill's role as secondary importance. She is also the author of East to Dawn, The Life of Amelia Earhart, called by the Washington Post the single best book that we now have on earth on Earhart's life. Ms. Butler is a freelance writer whose work regularly appears in the New York Times and Barron's. This lecture will be about 40 minutes, after which there will be time for questions. And as you may have noticed, there are copies of Dear Mr. Stalin for sale and signing outside in the lobby. And without further ado, please welcome Susan Butler.
Thank you very much, Jay. I'm honored to be the first speaker here, and I'm very happy to see all of you here. I hope you didn't have as much trouble finding it as I did. It was by accident that I actually, while I was researching in the library, in the Roosevelt Library, that I came upon the messages, because I found in somebody's on somebody's bookshelf copies of Stalin's messages to Roosevelt and Truman and Attlee and Churchill, and the volume that I was looking at was incomplete, and so I went to look for the complete book, the book of the complete messages that Roosevelt and Stalin had changed, and I found out there was no complete book. So that was how I got started on Roosevelt and Stalin, because I thought I have to find out everything they said to each other. It's much too important not to know. And in the end, of course, the book is there. There were 304 hot war messages that Roosevelt and Stalin exchanged. And they whetted my appetite, and I wanted to learn what, if any, effect Roosevelt had had on Stalin, and vice versa. And I have been reading ever since and developing contacts in the Russian archives. My new book is not going to be published, actually, for a couple of years. And it is called Roosevelt and Stalin, Winning the War, Shaping the Peace. President Roosevelt and Marshal Stalin were more than allies of convenience in World War II. They were partners. They had to be. And sharing the same outlook for the post-war world, they became friends of a sort. Roosevelt and Stalin, Winning the War, Shaping the Peace, reassesses the relationship of these two world leaders for the first time. Two elements have combined to prevent a prior reassessment of their relationship. First, of course, the crimes Stalin committed against his own people have obscured his critical contribution to the war and to the peace. And second, Churchill's account of World War II downgraded Stalin's role and his relationship to Roosevelt. Churchill was the master historian of the age, but he wrote history not as it happened, but how he wanted it to be seen. Quote, Churchill, "History will be kind to me," he said to an associate during the war, "for I intend to write it." Churchill's avowed goal was to forge an unbreakable, ongoing alliance between Great Britain and the United States that would bind the two English-speaking nations together forever. And in that, as we all know, he really succeeded. But to do it, he emphasized the concept that it was he and Roosevelt working together who saved Western civilization. In fact, by 1943, Roosevelt had relegated Churchill to secondary status. He and Stalin were organizing the world to establish the unbreakable peace. In Roosevelt and Churchill's last meetings together, according to biographer John Gunther, Churchill, on the defensive, always looked as if he were going to get hit, and Roosevelt was heard to say, "Yes, I am tired. So would you be if you had spent the last 5 years pushing Winston uphill in a wheelbarrow." Due to the recent availability of previously classified materials, it is now possible to reconstruct the Roosevelt-Stalin relationship. Roosevelt and Stalin, Winning the War, Shaping the Peace, will be the first book to write that little-known but critical element of history. When Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly of a cerebral hemorrhage in Warm Spring, Georgia, on April 12, 1945, the whole world mourned. In England, King George ordered the royal court to go into mourning for 7 days. In Soviet Russia, Stalin, equally distraught, ordered the Soviet nation to go into mourning. Kathleen Harriman, daughter of Averill Harriman, the American ambassador to the Soviet Union, wrote to her friend Pamela Churchill, "Jesus, it was a shock. Red flags with black borders hung from all houses today throughout Moscow, something I'd never guessed would happen. Virtually the entire Soviet nation reacted as if they had lost a real friend. All Soviet agencies hung flags of mourning from their buildings. It was an unimaginable occurrence that the bourgeois leader of a capitalist country should be so honored, that flags of mourning should fly over the Kremlin." The front pages of the Soviet papers announcing Roosevelt's death were framed with wide black borders. The lead article in Izvestia the day after he died quoted Stalin's condolence letter to Eleanor Roosevelt, in which Stalin called the president, quote, "the great organizer of the struggle of freedom-loving nations against the common enemy, and as the leader in the cause of ensuring security world over." And Soviet archives show these words are in Stalin's handwriting. To Harry Hopkins, who had written to Stalin of the loss by Russia of its greatest friend in America, Stalin wrote, "I agree completely with you. I personally feel deep sorrow in the loss of a trusted friend, a man of great spirit." Izvestia also tellingly, in view of the Marxist emphasis on class struggle, described Roosevelt as an ally of the American worker. Quote, "the leader of the great democracy across the ocean, he pursued the New Deal, which aimed at restricting monopolies and at improving the social conditions of broad masses of people. Pravda not only devoted space to the details of the funeral in the Capitol, it printed excerpts from FDR's Jefferson Day speech, a plea for peace, that Roosevelt was scheduled to give the day after he died. The work, quote, "the work, my friends, is peace, more than an end of this war, an end to all wars. Yes, an end forever to this impractical, unrealistic settlement of the differences between governments by mass killings of people." The NKVD reported that the president's death unsettled many Russians. The security agency found that there was a feeling of alarm, a worry that Roosevelt's successor, Truman, might not continue Roosevelt's policies on the most important issues of war, peace, and post-war security, might not stay friendly towards the Soviet Union. 3 weeks later, on May 8th, the war was over. Germany surrendered, and wild celebration was the order of the day. Loudspeakers all over Moscow blared out the Star-Spangled Banner along with the Internationale. Crowds of Russians drifted towards the American embassy. There they stood, or danced, or sang in the huge square in front of the embassy that backed onto the west wall of the Kremlin. As the day went on, the crowd continued to grow until it filled the square, then spilled over into the next square, also adjacent to the Kremlin. Muscovites kept waving, cheering, singing, pressing against the sides of the building, pushing past the police. George Kennan, 41 years old, the U.S. chargé d'affaires at the embassy, decided in the face of the nonstop enthusiasm to put up a Soviet flag next to the American flag. This action produced such roars of enthusiasm from the crowd that the ordinarily cool, collected Kennan decided a short speech of appreciation had to be made. And, accompanied by a sergeant in uniform, he climbed out onto the ledge formed by the top of a column just above the crowd. He shouted out in Russian, "Congratulations on the day of victory. All honor to the Soviet allies." This resulted in new roars of approval. The crowd, pressing closer around the pedestal, hoisted up a Soviet soldier till he was level with Kennan and the sergeant. The soldier proceeded to kiss and embrace the sergeant and then relentlessly pulled him down into the crowd. Kennan watched him bob helplessly over the sea of hands, almost disappearing from view before finally escaping. Kennan, meanwhile, successfully retreated back into the building. The crowd, resisting the continuous attempts of the Soviet police to move them on, stayed on well into the evening. My book tells the story of how the leader of the capitalist world and the leader of the communist world joined forces to defeat Hitler, and the brief sense of real alliance the two men forged. It describes Roosevelt and Stalin's modus operandi, what they knew about each other, and what they thought of each other. The story involves, as well, the influence, understanding, and idiosyncrasies of their staff. The two leaders met twice, at Tehran in November and December 1943, and at Yalta in February 1945, and they exchanged 304 hot war messages. By the time Roosevelt died in April 1945, they had come to a meeting of minds on a world organization to prevent war, agreed on the evils of colonialism, agreed that Germany must be dealt with as a future as well as a present threat, and finally that their mutual goal was to fashion a world without war for at least a generation. Roosevelt and Stalin tells how Franklin Roosevelt, immediately following Operation Barbarossa, which is Hitler's invasion of Russia on June 22nd, 1941, championed American aid to the Soviet Union. He set a policy that Soviet needs came first, even at the expense of projected U.S. military needs, and that no questions were to be asked. The president acted because only Russia stood between Hitler and Great Britain. Europe was already in his grasp. His armies ruled Poland, Czechoslovakia, Finland, Denmark, Norway, Luxembourg, Holland, Belgium, Greece, Yugoslavia, and France. Standing here today, it's almost, and everybody in the auditorium, I must think, just think how just totally incredible that was at that time, and how frightening. A year earlier, when the Luftwaffe was bombing England and German submarines were torpedoing British ships, when only the physical presence of the British Navy stood in the way of a German invasion across the Channel, Roosevelt had thrown the Navy a lifeline, 50 destroyers, to add to their decimated fleet. Now Roosevelt set about throwing a lifeline to the Soviet Union, aid on a massive scale, for if Hitler conquered Russia, England would again be in Hitler's sights. In Washington and throughout the United States, powerful figures for diverse reasons tried to stall Lend-Lease. Generals, admirals, members of Congress, corporate executives, newspaper publishers. Some believed aid was a useless waste of resources because Hitler was going to triumph. Some believed Stalin and communism were a greater danger than Hitler and Nazism. Some believed America would be safest if it retreated into isolation, protected by its oceans. The American Joint Chiefs of Staff were among those who at first did not want to help the Soviet Union. They mounted a concerted effort to disgrace and discredit the Russian expert Hopkins had put in charge of delivering U.S. aid. It was a last-ditch effort on their part to sabotage the effort, and they knew, because this man had a history of respecting the Soviet Union and fraternizing with Russians, that he was about to give the Russians everything they had asked for. Roosevelt acted upon information about the Soviet Union supplied by Joseph E. Davies, U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union in the late 30s, and Harry Hopkins, his most trusted associate. Davies was one of the few to have foreseen the circumstances that might force Stalin into a pact with Hitler. He had predicted the signing of that pact almost to the day. Hopkins was sent by Roosevelt to assess the Soviet Union's chances for survival a month after the German invasion. He relayed back his admiration for Stalin and his optimism that Russia could hold out. Next, Roosevelt established a chain of command to send the Soviet Union the tools of war, including guns, bombs, tanks, jeeps, ammunition, planes, aviation fuel, as well as food, clothing, field telephones, steel and aluminum for the factories, machine tools, railroad cars, railroad engines, warm boots, even amputation saws. When they met at Tehran in 1943, Roosevelt and Stalin discovered the similarity of their views. From Stalin's perspective, Germany's great crime was that it had invaded Russia twice in his lifetime. From Roosevelt's perspective, Germany's great crime was that it had twice destroyed the peace of the world. Roosevelt and Stalin shows that both men were aware that England and France had failed each time to stop the German onslaught. When Roosevelt and Stalin met, finally, with Churchill, the third of the big three, they discussed the steps necessary to ensure that Germany could not again menace civilization. Roosevelt's plan to prevent future wars rested upon the creation of an organization of nations endowed with vast powers, vast responsibilities, and universal membership, a functioning government of the world. In the initial planning stages, there were four policemen: the United States, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and China, which would have the power to intervene and quell, with weapons, any country that menaced another. Roosevelt drew Molotov and Stalin into the planning process in 1942, explaining and keeping them informed as changes were made. Stalin was favorably impressed. In late May 1942, Roosevelt had Sumner Wells, the Undersecretary of State, make a speech warning isolationists that U.S. soldiers will demand that the United Nations become the nucleus of a world organization of the future to determine the final terms of a just, an honest, and a durable peace. The Soviet press, which Stalin micromanaged, gave the speech wide coverage, emphasizing Wells' statement that the UN should be the basis of a post-war international organization. That June, Stalin and Roosevelt exchanged ideas on how to promote a long peace. As the German soldiers advanced into Russia, they killed on a massive scale, destroyed everything in their path. Wherever the war touched, the country had suffered grievous damage. 27 million Russians died in the war. Its cities and farms, as well as its industrial base, would have to be rebuilt. After defeating Hitler, Stalin knew his country would need, above all other things, a long peace. Roosevelt worked hard to become Stalin's friend, and many people think that he worked too hard. They took each other's measure at Tehran and at Yalta. Roosevelt pursued Stalin, always holding out the promise that his ideas were the best bet for future peace and security for Russia. Stalin was not sure that Roosevelt's concept of a world organization, even with police powers, was enough to keep Germany from starting a Third World War. They played cat and mouse. Roosevelt maneuvered to stay at the Soviet embassy in Tehran, even though he knew that Soviet intelligence agencies had a history of placing listening devices wherever important foreigners congregated. It meant Stalin would hear every word that Roosevelt and his staff exchanged. The president never explained his reason, but it is obvious. Extending and receiving hospitality is an ancient ritual used throughout history to forge the bonds of friendship. At Tehran, Stalin questioned Roosevelt's insistence on a peace organization that operated as one unit instead of being composed of regional bodies that would have, as in the past, divided the world into spheres of influence. He decided to support Roosevelt in spite of his reservations, because spheres of influence had not stopped Hitler. Roosevelt and Stalin traces the ups and downs of their relationship, the aid asked for and the aid delivered, the reasons for and the effect of the delay of the launching of the invasion of France, the Second Front, until 1944, on both men, the relative position of Winston Churchill on Roosevelt and Stalin, and the degree to which Roosevelt and Stalin relied on each other. In addition, the book analyzes Roosevelt's thoughts on the development of the atom bomb and on the merits and consequences of sharing control of the bomb with the Soviet Union. FDR discussed this matter at length with Secretary of War Henry Stimson, Prime Minister Mackenzie King of Canada, and Prime Minister Winston Churchill. And these discussions were going on with Roosevelt in March, the month before he died. Only Winston Churchill was against sharing control of the bomb with Russia. Roosevelt and Stalin also lays out the colonial issue. Roosevelt was strongly against colonialism and the consequences of powerful nations controlling weaker nations. In the first year of his presidency, he had repudiated America's right to intervene in the internal or external affairs of South American countries. Within a short time, FDR had recommended self-government for Puerto Rico, pushed Congress to pass an act giving independence to the Philippines after a 10-year period of transition, relinquished the right of the United States to intervene in Cuban affairs, and ordered the last Marines to leave Haiti. The French colonial position in Vietnam, then called Indochina, incensed the president. As he remarked at Tehran, after a century of French rule in Indochina, the inhabitants were worse off than they had been before. He was equally eloquent on the conditions that existed in Great Britain's possessions. He was appalled by Churchill's position on India and had sent Hopkins to London to see if he could change the prime minister's mind. Hopkins had pushed the prime minister to begin giving what Churchill called the brown people authority over their own affairs. Millions had just died of starvation in Bengal. Stalin agreed with Roosevelt's proposition that colonialism should end. Undoubtedly, the issue was attractive to Stalin because the loss of their colonies would weaken West European countries. But the idea of colonialism was also at odds with the doctrine of communism. For Roosevelt, the issue was the evil exploitation of one civilization by another. He believed in, quote, the right of all people to choose the form of government under which they will live, as the Atlantic Charter affirmed. But both leaders saw colonialism as aggravating the trouble that leads to war. Coming from different directions, the two leaders had a meeting of minds on the issue. They considered the idea of trusteeship as an interim solution. At the end of the war, the United States and the Soviet Union had become the only two superpowers. At Tehran, at Yalta, and in their correspondence, it could be seen that the president was obsessed with setting up an all-nation government of the world. At every opportunity, he mentioned, in some context, that a United Nations built on his model could maintain peace for 25 years, for a generation. And that United Nations included, as a prerequisite, Soviet membership. Stalin began to treat Roosevelt as the key to a peaceful world. The problem of borders, or rather of security guarantees of our specific borders, will be decided by force, Stalin said to Molotov in 1942. Roosevelt held out the carrot that the United Nations would be that force and drew Stalin in as the Russian leader realized that to have a friendly America as the decisive force would be in the interest of the Soviet Union. At the Dumbarton Oaks Conference in Washington, D.C. in the fall of 1944, the major points of the UN organization were hammered out. In November 1944, Stalin made a speech extolling the Grand Alliance. Quote, the foundation for the alliance of the USSR, Great Britain, and the USA lies not in chance and passing considerations, but in vitally important and long-term interests. On January 20th, 1945, the day Roosevelt was inaugurated for his fourth term, Molotov recorded in his diary that Harriman informed him that at the upcoming Yalta conference, The president wanted to discuss all matters treated with Germany, all questions left open after Dumbarton Oaks. And next, the president wants to talk about Poland, and then finally the war in the Pacific. Stalin wanted American commitment to make a loan to help the Soviet Union rebuild. Harriman told Molotov to make a wish list and present it at Yalta. Ambassador Gromyko, meanwhile, reported that U.S. insistence on the U.N. was the best indication that the USA will be interested in maintenance of peace, which just shows that they were as suspicious of us as we were of them. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, and particularly General Douglas MacArthur, insisted that the Soviet government in the war against Japan was a necessity. Stalin set this date for Soviet forces to enter Manchuria to support America's invasion of Japan. Roosevelt, in return, agreed to give the Soviet Union the territory it lost to Japan in 1904. There were serious clashes between Roosevelt and Stalin, particularly over Poland, on Russia's western border. The Germans had marched through Poland, Russia's ancient enemy, twice in the 20th century. Stalin began to insist on control of Poland, and yet at Yalta, at Roosevelt's request, he signed the Declaration on Liberated Europe that promised free and unfettered elections. Stalin was actually of two minds about Poland. He wanted it friendly, strong, and independent. However, he deeply mistrusted the old-line Polish aristocrats who dominated the Polish government in exile, not just for their unrealistic territorial demands, but because he knew they would never forgive him for ordering the murder of the flower of the Polish officer corps in 1940. Stalin was extraordinarily sensitive to any possibility of betrayal by his wartime allies. The month before Roosevelt died, Stalin learned that Russia, although notified, had been excluded from the truce negotiations the United States and Great Britain were holding with a German general in Switzerland. In retaliation, he announced that instead of sending Foreign Minister Molotov to the San Francisco conference, he was going to send the less important Andrei Gromyko, the ambassador, to the United States. Roosevelt wrote Stalin explaining that no negotiations had taken place. He put his word on the line in the message. Quote, "With a confidence in your belief in my personal reliability, it would be one of the great tragedies of history if at the moment of victory now within our grasp, such distrust, such lack of faith should prejudice the entire undertaking." Stalin replied that he didn't doubt the president, it was the people around him. Quote, "You have not been fully informed." Then, obviously positively affected by Roosevelt's words, the next thing he did after he received Roosevelt's message was to order Molotov to summon the Japanese ambassador to the Kremlin and tell him the neutrality pact between their two countries was null and void. The last message Roosevelt sent to Stalin was a plea to get along. There must not, in any event, be mutual mistrust. Roosevelt's death deeply affected Stalin, remembered Averell Harriman, the American ambassador to the Soviet Union, who saw him the following day. Stalin was more disturbed than I had ever seen him, according to Harriman, and said to him, "President Roosevelt has died, but his cause must live on. We shall support President Truman with all our forces and all our will." The San Francisco conference, at which representatives of the Allied Nations were convening to establish the United Nations, was scheduled for April 25, 1945. Less than 2 weeks later. In the weeks before his death, the president had spent his time meticulously planning his journey, laying out the train route he would take to San Francisco, the possible stops, deciding and notifying the companions who would travel with him. All the details attendant upon his arrival to make the opening speech at this momentous first meeting, which he had worked so hard to bring about. Harriman now suggested to Stalin that if he genuinely wanted to further Roosevelt's goals and show his respect, he would allow Molotov to attend the San Francisco conference after all. Stalin then announced that he would indeed change his mind and Molotov could go. Mr. Molotov's trip to the United States, although difficult at this time, would be arranged, he replied to Ambassador Harriman. When Germany surrendered 3 weeks later, Stalin expected his allies to insist on reparations in kind from Germany, as had been discussed at Yalta, as well as measures to prevent Germany from again menacing its neighbors. He looked forward to a continuation of the Grand Alliance. He had no plans to go to war to dominate Western Europe. He expected instead that the Western democracies would gravitate towards socialism because he believed that socialism was a better economic system and would be the wave of the future. This most paranoid leader was looking for time and money, time for the Soviet Union to rebuild, money to make it happen. In the 20 years that he had been at the helm, he had transformed the Soviet Union from an illiterate pastoral country into an educated industrial giant. At war's end, with nearly 20% of its population dead, its cities in ruins, its manufacturing base a shambles, his country needed peace to rebuild, time to heal. Roosevelt and Stalin describes the sometimes blundering way Stalin went about attaining it. Roosevelt had been at once the leader of the Grand Alliance and its vital center. As the war progressed, he stilled the doubting voices of both his allies. He made Churchill and Stalin work together. He calmed Stalin's great, oft-stated fear of a resurgent Germany. Was it simply the case that without the president, the center could not hold? That lacking their mutual trust in Roosevelt, the alliance between Stalin and Churchill had to break down? Was the Cold War the result of Roosevelt's death? Exactly a month after Roosevelt died, Churchill informed Truman that an Iron Curtain was descending across Europe. A year later, the eloquent old warrior, who had stirred up the British people to withstand Hitler's aerial onslaught, spoke in Fulton, Missouri, and informed the world that the Iron Curtain was descending. I'm going to read now just a few pages from the book that I've, which is when Roosevelt and Stalin first met. It's Sunday, November. It's 1943. Scarcely had the president arrived at the Russian embassy Sunday, November 28, when at 3:15, Stalin paid him a call. The president was at last face to face with the most elusive quarry he had ever sought. Would Stalin go along with what he would propose? Would he stick to an agreement when the present emergency was over? 3 years earlier, Hitler had wanted to arrange a meeting with Stalin, or at least he had voiced such a desire to Molotov. Two statesmen like us ought to get together, and I am ready for such a meeting to take place as soon as possible, Hitler had said. Yet within the year, German troops had invaded Russia. The thought must have crossed Stalin's ever-suspicious mind that through this meeting with Roosevelt had gone to such great lengths to arrange, even he might be trying to blunt the vigilance of the Soviet government. Roosevelt was the first person he had met since Lenin who was at least as powerful as he, a president elected to an unprecedented third term, running what had become the most productive industrial engine in the world, an engine that was now the main support of the Soviet Union. This man, this cripple, who did not look or act like a cripple, whose clothes hung on him so well that he appeared seated on the couch, not just physically normal, but elegant, had traveled thousands of miles to meet him. He was now housed, due almost entirely to his own initiative, in Stalin's own embassy. Clearly, Stalin had to think this president was made of strong stuff. It was a beautiful Sunday afternoon, golden blue, mild and sunny, when the two leaders finally met in Roosevelt's sitting room. In spite of his most strenuous efforts to be included, Churchill was not there. Roosevelt had been resting in his bedroom, having just arrived at the embassy when he was told Stalin was on his way over. Nevertheless, he managed to be seated, waiting on the couch in the sitting room when Stalin made his appearance with a most engaging grin on his face, remembered Mike Riley, head of security for Roosevelt. He walked toward the boss very slowly, sort of ambled across the room towards Roosevelt, grinning and reaching down to shake FDR's hand for the first time. As they shook hands, the boss grinned too and said, "It's good to see you, Marshal." And the Marshal burst into a gay laugh. Stalin sat down, then recalled Roosevelt. I caught him looking curiously at my legs and ankles. Roosevelt wore a navy business suit, white shirt, and a conservative tie. A handkerchief peeked out from his vest pocket. He had a frank, clear gaze and a welcoming smile that could light up a room. He now turned it on Stalin. Roosevelt was famous for his charm and manner. He could make a casual visitor believe that nothing was so important to him that day as this particular visit, and that he had been waiting all day for this hour to arrive. He inspired an intense loyalty nearly everywhere in his administration. Young and ardent idealists, old and tired politicians, professors, even businessmen who joined up with him were ready to work at all hours of the day or night to carry out his bidding. Harold Ickes confessed, "I never had contact with a man who was loved as he is." He also had a special way of throwing his head up, which seemed a gesture of courage. It attracted people. Unlike when he had seen him in the summer of 1941, when Hopkins had noted Stalin's rather baggy trousers, lack of medals, and his simple but well-cut gray jacket, Stalin now wore one of the smart new Soviet military uniforms, a mustard-colored marshal's jacket with red epaulets and white stars on the shoulders, and knife-edge trousers with broad red stripes. The star of the Order of Lenin hung from his neck. Stalin didn't look the way people expected. He was smaller. He was short, only 5'4", although many people, including Roosevelt, would comment that he seemed bigger, probably because his body was so thick-set and powerful. Hopkins, too, who met him when he was under great pressure in July 1941, had come away with the distinct impression that he was a bigger man, about 5'6". He's built close to the ground, like a football coach's dream of a tackle. His hands are huge, as hard as his mind. He had a thick mustache, dark hair, a low forehead, and what many people said were oriental, honey-colored eyes. Although his Russian was correct in every respect, he had a Georgian accent, an accent as distinct from the ordinary Russian as a Scottish burr was to the English language. Also, surprisingly, he spoke in a low, controlled voice that he sometimes pitched so low it seemed as if he was talking to himself. He also surprised people because he looked less grand than his pictures, which must have been retouched before they were released. His face was pockmarked from the smallpox he had suffered as a child. His teeth were broken and stained. Additionally, when he filled his pipe with tobacco, it could be seen that the motion of his left arm, the result of a childhood accident, was slightly awkward. Another surprise was his manner. Although he was tough, arbitrary, stern, and cold, he came across to newcomers as avuncular and patient, less threatening than they expected. General John Dean, the U.S. coordinator of Lend-Lease and military affairs stationed in Moscow in 1943, who came to know just how obstinate and tough he was, nevertheless wrote that upon meeting him, "I was struck most of all by the kindly expression on his deeply wrinkled, sallow face." Lord Beaverbrook, who with Harriman went to Moscow in October 1941 to arrange the first flow of aid, thought he was, quote, "a kindly man, with a habit when agitated of walking about the floor with his hands behind his back." One of Stalin's trusted associates wrote, "It was hard to imagine such a man could deceive you." His reactions were so natural, without the slightest sense of him posing. He even impressed Cordell Hull, who wrote, "Any American having Stalin's personality and approach might well reach high public office in my own country." And Stalin was also known for his charm, according to his biographer Simon Sebag Montefiore, in spite of the habit he wreaked upon his enemies or those he imagined might become his enemies. To his inner circle, he was very approachable and very thoughtful. The foundation of Stalin's power in the party was not fear, it was charm. He was what is known as a people person. While incapable of true empathy on the one hand, he was a master of friendships on the other. He constantly lost his temper, but when he set his mind to charming a man, he was irresistible. His associates called him Soso, his childhood name, or Koba, the name of a brave Georgian he admired as a teenager, or used the informal version of you. A person meeting him was anxious to see him again. He created a sense that there was a new bond that linked them forever, wrote his biographer. He was also utterly domineering. He ran the lives of his associates down to the smallest detail. He chose where they lived. For Lavrenti Beria, head of the NKVD, he selected a sumptuous nobleman's mansion near the Kremlin. For Nikita Khrushchev, a then favored younger man, he allotted a palatial apartment in the pink Granovsky block near the Kremlin. For other members of his inner circle, he decided on an apartment like the one he himself lived in, inside the Kremlin, which was much simpler. He chose the cars his associates used, dispensed money to them periodically, and gave them, and usually their children, thoughtful presents. No detail was too small. He was a workaholic. He found time to view many new Soviet movies, most newspaper editorials and news articles, as well as all manners of directives issued by the commissariats that controlled Soviet Russia, all of which were funneled first through Molotov's office. On his desk was a bronze cup full of thick, pointed blue and red pencils. When he approved a movie, an editorial, an article, a directive, he scrawled his initial, JS, across the document with a thick blue pencil. When he did not approve a document, he scribbled upon it with a red pencil. Such occasions would profoundly upset Molotov. This first historic meeting in Roosevelt's sitting room lasted 40 minutes, half of which was taken up with translating. Roosevelt spoke first. The meeting is notable for the lack of preliminary small talk, its directness, the ease with which they answered each other's questions, and the remarkable similarity of attitudes between the two. Also notable is the fact that it is Roosevelt who sets the agenda and steers the conversation. He would continue to do so at all their meetings. Thank you very much. That is the end of my talk. The most fascinating thing for me when I started to study this was to find out how terribly wounded the Soviet Union was after the war, that they had lost 27 million people, 8 million of it, who were soldiers, and what terrible shape they were in. As a comparison, in the United States, America lost 405,000 people. So I would love to hear what anybody thinks about my project. Yes. Could you talk a little louder? Yes.
Are playing a very decisive role. My question is, how aware, is there a real political awareness of this exchange historically, or is this a real discovery? I mean, this is coming from an ignorant person about this area of studies, but I find this whole subject really interesting in terms of the exchange between allied powers and how this, you know, how instrumental that is in shaping the history.
Well, I think there's more of an awareness as the years go by, because I pick up more and more books which talk about the secondary position of Churchill and how Roosevelt and Stalin were basically running things. I mean, there's a book that just came out called Citizen of London, which, you know, there are many books now are. It's like, you know, every generation reassesses history, and as we all put a lens now on certainly one of, I don't know how many people, put a lens on World War II, we find out that things were not quite as we thought they were.
But how would you say your personal approach? Because obviously history doesn't exist, it's our interpretation.
Yes.
And your interpretation also of what has happened, even for example, the way you painted the meeting between the two men.
Yes.
Because in a fictional way,
It's perfect. It's absolutely factual.
Yeah, I mean, but it's still fiction, imagining the human aspect.
Yes. Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to do because I'm of the opinion that it's great men, great people, men and women who make history. So I take the biographical approach. Absolutely. Yes.
Do you find any traces of that, of those opinions being different in the conversation between two men? Because Roosevelt is still considered a chaplain of the Free World War style, and it's not even mother, bigger country, one of the most, I think, poor and terrible
yes.
players the world has ever seen. So you can describe him as a friendly man, but in the end, it's. Yeah.
Well, Roosevelt never, Roosevelt made one speech before America was in the war in 1941, saying what a terrible dictator Stalin was. But he never confronted Stalin personally with the NKVD or the power of death that he held over his own citizens. It's perfectly true that he was for his own people a terrible man. However, the only person in the world that he ever said anything nice about was Franklin Roosevelt. So really, I think Roosevelt and certainly Stimson, Secretary of War, they thought possibly they could change the Soviet Union and open it up. And they certainly hoped that they could control the foreign policy. Roosevelt is obviously supported my book, that Roosevelt was trying to create Stalin's foreign policy in a much more benign way. But he and Stimson discussed the repression in the Soviet Union, but Roosevelt did not believe in interfering in other countries' domestic affairs because, I mean, he was a very practical man. He wasn't going to get anywhere. Well, you know, it's a very interesting question because I've come upon a number of Roosevelt's comments, which I've never seen put together, and I'm going to put them all together, where he is questioning whether it's the best thing not to, as Churchill wants Roosevelt to just not tell Stalin about the bomb. Churchill and Roosevelt had signed an agreement that they were keeping the secret of the bomb to the two of them, and Roosevelt was reconsidering. Roosevelt was seriously reconsidering when he died, and you know one has to think if you have two great countries who are allies during a war, and supposedly are going to stay allies in the peace, and one of them has the ultimate weapon and hides it from the other, what is the other country supposed to do? I mean, especially if that country has a totally paranoid ruler. So, I mean, it's a fascinating question, which nobody's ever going to be able to answer. But what would have happened if Roosevelt had lived? Roosevelt, whom Stalin trusted, Truman, whom he didn't trust. Would the Cold War have been so cold, you know? I mean, one doesn't know.
Just a few comments. First of all, at Yalta, three votes in the United Nations.
In the General Assembly.
In the General Assembly, which indicated, as you were illustrating, how determined Roosevelt was to get an agreement on the UN. And also, Poland is probably another reason why Stalin decided not to send Molotov to the UN conference, because they were so angry about the U.S. refusal to recognize communist domination in Poland at that time. But otherwise, I think your description of the relationship is absolutely fascinating. I look very much forward to your book.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
Many people fault Roosevelt for acquiescing or delivering Eastern Europe to the Soviets, to become the Soviet. Can you comment on how, at Yalta, about how that came about?
But you see, it didn't happen at Yalta. He didn't give away anything at Yalta, although it's not commonly... I mean, it's commonly accepted that he did give away a lot at Yalta. But what he did at Yalta was he got Stalin to sign an agreement. And the agreement promised free and unfettered elections in Poland. It also, they also set up a representative government, which was going to be composed of the Lublin Poles. That was the ones that Stalin controlled, but it also was going to include some of the London Poles, the government in exile, who were basically anti-Stalin. But so they came to an agreement on Poland at Yalta. But what happened was that Stalin broke his word. He did not keep his end of the bargain. And as far as the three votes. The three votes were in the General Assembly, and Churchill was strongly in favor of the extra votes because he wanted all the votes for the British Empire. And as far as Roosevelt was concerned, he knew that votes in the General Assembly didn't mean a thing because all the power was in the Security Council. So, I mean, you know, he was just manipulating people. But that was after Roosevelt died. Yes.
They broke later.
On this thing, how much do we really know about Roosevelt? I mean, he didn't leave any, like, as I understand it. There's, like, very little personal notes, anything like, you know, comments that he might have on something. I mean, you really don't have much to work with in us knowing what was going through his head. He was secretive, just about as secretive as Stalin was?
You're right, he was. He was as secretive as Stalin. And the interesting thing is that he had much more power than I realized. I mean, he had much more power. The only way to even begin to figure out what Roosevelt was thinking is through other people's diaries. Now, Stimson kept a wonderful diary. Every single time he went to see Roosevelt, he would basically explode when he came home. And
so aren't these letters, like, written? They probably knew that their letters weren't going to be, you know, out there for historians to, you know, to go over. What they've been written is like politicians that they, whenever they put anything in writing, they know that it's going to be picked over, and they're writing it more for effect.
No, those letters were not written for effect at all. Those letters were written because they were part, because these two leaders were part of a grand alliance. They were trying to win a war. I didn't.
And it's my dear Joe, or my dear, you know.
My dear Mr. Well, yeah, go ahead. He never says my dear Joe.
All right. But he's like really chummy in those things. He's talking like, as you've indicated, you know, they got along rather well for a while. Even though Roosevelt knew, I mean, that the guy was making lists of names and checks and X's and X's and that, people that would never be seen again. You know, it's already been commented on, you know, about how repressive he was to his people.
But what Roosevelt...
I appreciate that you said that he would want to get involved in a country's internal...
Yeah, but Roosevelt was interested... Yes, you're right. But Roosevelt was interested in preserving the peace of the world. And there was nothing he could do with the internal affairs in the Soviet Union. But what he could do was make Stalin do what he wanted in the international sphere. And he did. He succeeded. I mean, if you think about it, you think about the Cold War, there were no lives lost in the Cold War.
All right, here's one example. We could have held back before we started our front coming, you know, to invade Europe. And the Germans would have continued doing that.
No, that's very complicated. No, we couldn't have held. We did everything. We did everything as efficiently in the war as we possibly could. There's no doubt about that. There was nothing political about it. Roosevelt and Marshall wanted to win the war with the least loss of life to American servicemen. So, all right, one more question. Yes. Well, but they were clamoring for a cross-channel invasion immediately. But we didn't have the landing craft, and we didn't have the ships to get ready soon enough. And in the beginning, Roosevelt was sort of feeling his way. No American general had been in a war, so instead we invaded French North Africa, which did the same thing. I mean, it pulled people away and pulled German soldiers from the Soviet Union. So, how are we doing, Jay? Can we take more questions? Okay.
Were you able to find any candid observations or descriptions of Stalin from a Soviet source? Because I could imagine that one would be very hesitant to write something about Stalin.
Well, you know, those statements that I was quoting about how charming he was, I was so stunned. Now, those come from a very recent biography of Stalin, and from Soviet sources by Simon Sebag Montefiore. So there are people who, you know, the stuff is still filtering out, made comments about Stalin then, and are still making comments, and new information is still, I mean, it's not coming, not a huge amount, but there's still information trickling out.
But is it contemporary to Stalin?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you really want to know, if you want to know a lot about Stalin, it's a very thick, heavy book, but it's full of interesting information, and it's by Simon Sebag Montefiore, and it's called Stalin, the Last Tsar. And it's full of stuff from Soviet archives, which has been uncovered in the last 10 years. Thank you very much for coming. I hope you'll come to the others.